With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Ugh. Jeez. Hi, it's Lizzie. This is a little audio I recorded of myself on Monday, June 27th, when I had COVID. At that point, I'd been sick for 2 weeks. And because I have an autoimmune disease, I went on the antiviral drug Paxlovid just after I tested positive. Here's some more tape.
I felt probably significantly better after being on it for four days. When I took a test, a home test, I was still positive, but only had a very faint line. And then that, when I went off the Paxlovid, the 5-day course, I started feeling sicker again. And my fever, which has never been high, came back just a little bit. And then I started testing strongly positive. That is how I sound when I cough. I'm gonna be fine, but this is it's been a bit of a roller coaster.
Again, I'm fine. I'm vaccinated, I'm boosted, I have access to great medical care. But I recorded this audio because what happened to me is now something of a hot topic among people who've taken Paxlovid.
So it sounds like you had a pretty standard case of what folks have been calling either COVID rebound or Paxlovid rebound.
That's Rachel Gutman-Way. She's been writing about Paxlovid for The Atlantic.
Which is when, after taking the full 5-day course of the drug, people start feeling poorly again, testing positive after a certain number of days.
It happened to me, and it happened to Anthony Fauci, who took Paxlovid, tested negative, and then tested positive again.
And then over the next day or so, I started to feel really poorly. Much worse than in the first go-around.
The rebounds don't seem to be landing people in the hospital or leading to death, but they're not fun. And more importantly, they have public health implications because people who thought they weren't contagious anymore actually might be.
There was one particular case study of a 67-year-old who, during a rebound that I don't know if he realized he had at the time, gave COVID to his grandson.
Oof.
Yeah.
But what we don't really know yet is what's driving these rebounds and how common they truly are. Why do you think this feels like such a zeitgeisty question right now?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it's sort of like a microcosm of wanting to be done with COVID, right? Like, we've thought we're done with COVID so many times when there was the first big vaccine rollout in end of 2020, early 2021. We kind of thought we were done, or that it was possible that we could be done. You know, the whole world will get vaccinated, herd immunity, yada, yada, sunshine and roses. And that kind of feels similar to having COVID, getting this drug that's supposed to make you better, sort of thinking you're in the clear, and then just, you know, it's all undone and you feel like you're back to square one. It's sort of like the hamster wheel of the pandemic in miniature.
Today on the show, unraveling the mysteries of Paxlovid. Is it really a miracle drug? I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to What Next TBD, a show about technology, power, and how the future will be determined. Stick with us.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
In December of 2021, the Food and Drug Administration granted Pfizer an emergency use authorization for Paxlovid. The U.S. government placed an order for millions of courses of treatment, and pretty quickly, the drug was met with resounding praise.
It was called a monster breakthrough, miraculous, the biggest advance in the pandemic since the vaccines.
These pills are going to dramatically decrease hospitalizations and deaths from COVID-19. They're a game changer.
And what garnered the headlines and praise were some pretty amazing numbers from Pfizer's clinical trial about how well the drug worked to keep people out of the hospital and keep them from dying.
So there were two main sort of sections of the clinical trial. Number one was in unvaccinated people who had some kind of risk factor for severe COVID. That's the high-risk group. So the high-risk portion in unvaccinated people found an 89% reduction in risk of hospitalization and death. Like, it was great.
That's stunning.
It's fantastic. It's really, really important that that population can be protected because they're at the highest risk of going to the hospital, having severe complications, possibly dying from COVID. And, you know, there are still 300 people or so dying a day from COVID, and presumably some of them are not vaccinated and have, you know, these sort of risk factors. So protecting them is super important.
But there was another part of the trial, what's called the standard risk trial. That was made up of people who were either vaccinated and had a risk factor or were unvaccinated but had a standard risk.
It was sort of a different story in the standard risk trial. So that's people who are vaccinated, but it excluded anybody who had received a vaccine in the last 12 months. Which is interesting because a lot of vaccinated people got their vaccines in the last 12 months. And this that particular requirement was updated around April, which would have been about 12 months after most people were getting their first and second doses. And if you've had a booster between now and then, you're also excluded. So it's still only a portion of vaccinated people. And also those people who are unvaccinated but don't have risk factors. They didn't really find any significant effects of the drug on preventing hospitalization, ICU admissions, or death. They found trends pointing in the right way, but they weren't statistically significant. They also didn't find any benefit in terms of having symptoms for a shorter amount of time, symptom alleviation, any of that. So it's not as clear from the standard risk data what exactly Paxlovid has to offer for vaccinated people.
How much data exists on a vaccinated person or a vaccinated and boosted person taking Paxlovid and what kind of efficacy the drug has for them?
There was an Israeli study about a month and a half ago that looked at both vaccinated and unvaccinated people, and it was crucially done during the Omicron era. So another important thing about the high-risk trial is that it was conducted pretty much completely in the Delta era.
Hmm.
So some of the difference, you know, the daylight between the amazing results in the high-risk trial and the not as great results in the standard risk trial could also have something to do with the variant. But this Israeli study basically found that people over 65, whether they're vaccinated or not, got a ton of benefit from Paxlovid, and people under 65 got virtually none, regardless of their vaccination status.
Now that we are in this scenario where people can get it and get it for free because the U.S. government has purchased a lot, who is supposed to be prescribed Paxlovid right now? I think that is a little bit confusing to people.
Yeah, and it's confusing to doctors, too. There was an announcement that pharmacists can prescribe it, too. So there are even more people who can prescribe it and still not a ton of clarity about who exactly it's supposed to be going to. The emergency use authorization from the FDA is fairly broad. It's basically, if you're over 12 and you have COVID and it's been 5 days or fewer since your symptoms started and you have a risk factor, then you can have it. And I mean, the risk factor word language has been pretty broad since the beginning of COVID for lots of good reasons, in order to get people vaccines when they needed it, in order to get them all sorts of other resources. But at the same time, you could have a perfectly healthy 15-year-old with mild asthma be eligible for Paxlovid.
How widespread is its use?
Since it was authorized in December and as of June 26th, which is the most recent HHS data that's available, more than 1.8 million Americans have taken it. So it's a lot.
While Paxlovid clearly has benefits, there are still a lot of unknowns about it, including why it can cause a weird side effect known as Paxlovid mouth.
People have described it as bitter, sour, metallic. One person described it to me like if you mixed grapefruit juice and soap together. Somebody said it tastes like burnt grapefruit. It doesn't sound good. Pfizer said that was happening in 5 or 6% of people, but almost everybody I spoke to for the article about Paxlovid mouth said, no way. Like, it's happening to way, way, way more people. And I spoke to a couple of dozen people just in my reporting on Paxlovid, and every single one had Paxlovid mouth.
Then there is the issue of rebound. I think it might be helpful to define what we're talking about when we say rebound. How would you describe it?
I would say that rebound is if you have taken Paxlovid, you've finished your course, your symptoms have abated, you test negative, and then within a few days, you get a reversal. So you test positive again, your symptoms come back.
That feels pretty similar to what happened to me, although I never tested negative. I only had like a tiny little faint line.
Right.
Rebound feels like a significant thing to talk about, though, because it makes me wonder whether there's any data on if the treatment is extending the course of the infectious period, or if you had this moment where you tested negative and you started socializing, or you felt, I'm in the clear, and then you go out and infect people. It feels like a very thorny question, not just for individuals, but for public health.
Absolutely. And that's what you were talking about, the scenario in which people think they're in the clear and then go out and infect other people, is one of the reasons why it's really important to find out exactly how widespread Paxlovid rebound is. I mean, if it's really only happening in a few percent of people, then maybe it is okay to tell people, you know what, if you finish your course, it's been 10 days since the start of your symptoms, like, you're free. But, you know, if 10 or 20% of people are getting rebound, we might want to issue different guidance.
Pfizer has said that it's seen a rebound rate of about 2% of patients who take Paxlovid. But as the drug is more widely adopted, patient experiences seem like they might tell a different story.
I mean, part of the problem with the Pfizer data is that all we have is a number. All we have is 2%. We don't really know where they got that number from. They haven't released the data behind it, at least not that I have seen. The Mayo Clinic study that found that it was closer to 1% was in 483 people, which is a lot of people, but maybe not enough to really suss out the incidence when this is being given to close to 2 million people at this point. People I spoke to said that this would be the kind of thing that it would be good to study within a hospital system. So to just track everybody that a particular system prescribes Paxlovid to and then see what happens. And there are certainly people who are doing that, but there just haven't been results yet.
When we come back, what are the stakes for society if Paxlovid isn't as good as we thought?
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey everybody, it's Neil. I've got some huge news. Decoder is moving to Mondays and Thursdays. We're adding a second episode to the show. On Mondays, we'll have our classic interviews with CEOs and other troublemakers.
I think we're going to have to start having conversations about how do we pay those jobs that can't be done by AI.
And on Thursdays, we'll be explaining big topics in the news with Verge reporters, experts, and other friends of the show.
There's a new generation of people on the internet. Google search has always sucked for them. So, you know, there's no reason for them to be loyal. They can just go to TikTok.
This is going to be really fun. I'm very excited about all this. So go subscribe wherever you get your podcasts now.
There was something in your story that really stuck out to me, and I feel like it highlighted why this is so important, because you wrote that an individual patient would never know, really, if Paxlovid worked for them, because you can't know how sick you would have gotten if you didn't take it. But there's this idea that if the drug doesn't do that much for vaccinated people, that giving it out and spending, you know, the country's money on it might be a waste of our dwindling resources. And it makes me wonder, how do we know if we're spending our money and energy well as a country in kind of the arsenal of our tools to fight COVID?
This is a question that goes way beyond Paxlovid. It's something that we've been struggling with basically the whole pandemic. America's tendency to sort of focus on one thing and run with it. And so we could say that we're in an era of, you know, Paxlovid is the thing now. We've tried vaccines. We've given up on masks. We've given up on vaccine mandates. We vaccinated some people. Let's just throw Paxlovid at everybody, put all our eggs in that basket. And as far as exactly how much money we should be spending on it or whether it's a waste, I think that's more of a public health / political judgment call. You know, if we had unlimited funding, then giving people Paxlovid when it's not necessarily doing a ton for them might not be that much of an issue. But when it's taking up half of the funding that Congress has been able to agree on, then that's a stickier issue. And it's really an open question whether that funding could be better spent doing further vaccine outreach, which has still been shown to, you know, connect with some holdouts and get them vaccination, or whether that could be better spent upgrading ventilation in schools and public buildings. There are lots of other things that money could be spent on. And Paxlovid isn't necessarily an inherently bad investment for the country to make.
What else don't we know about Paxlovid? And what do you want to know? I mean, when I went on it, I was struck by the fact that there's basically no data on breastfeeding. And I'm at the end of breastfeeding my child. And, you know, my doctor's saying, well, you probably shouldn't, but there's no real data. Check with your pediatrician. And pediatrician's like, I don't know. I was shocked by how little information there is.
I would say that's a huge outstanding question. One of the biggest ones for me is whether Paxlovid has any effect on long COVID.
Hmm.
So there are some folks who have long COVID who have been pushing for research about whether Paxlovid can actually alleviate long COVID if you already have it. And then the other question is, does taking Paxlovid while you have COVID prevent you from getting long COVID afterward? That's a really important question, I think, especially as a lot of the country has sort of adopted this posture of, you know, everyone's going to get it. Consequences are what they are. The consequences are a little bit different if, you know, a significant portion of the country is going to have these long-term effects that impede their life.
But of course, all of this takes a long time to study, especially when it comes to tracking long COVID and what kind of treatments might be helpful.
These are effects that last months and apparently years. And so you would really want to follow up with people over months and years. So we're not going to have answers on that for a while. And if you get COVID today and you're somebody who has maybe a risk factor, but you're young, you're not super worried, like nobody can tell you whether Paxlovid would decrease your chances of getting long COVID, which, I mean, for me, I am not immunocompromised. I am young. COVID does not scare me that much personally. I'm vaccinated. Like, I know that I'm very unlikely to end up in the hospital or die from COVID. But the thing that scares me most personally right now is, well, we don't really know who's getting long COVID, and it could be me. And so if I were faced with, you know, oh, well, we don't know, if Paxlovid could possibly maybe prevent this outcome that possibly maybe could happen to you. I don't know what I would do about that.
Zooming out a little bit, I wonder a lot about kind of if this is just how it has to be with drugs and treatments that are developed in the middle of a public health emergency. And I want to be careful not to say that there are safety risks here or anything like that, but just that we are in this real-time data collection event in which we are all data points.
We've all been guinea pigs since the beginning of the pandemic, too. There are a lot of ways that we're being guinea pigs right now. There are sort of particularities of the FDA's authorization process and drug development in the US that make it different from other countries. And it could be different in the details, but sort of the balance between certainty and speed in drug development, I don't really know that there's a way around that. I think that's sort of a law of nature.
What do you think happens now? Is there going to be a souped up Paxlovid? Will there be some other wonder drug? I mean, I keep wondering what our toolbox is going to look like from a national and international perspective, or whether, as you mentioned before, we're too focused on individual tools and have lost the ability to zoom out and think, this doesn't need to be an either or, but an and kind of question.
As far as the future of Paxlovid itself, one of the interesting things that we'll want to see is that Pfizer and the NIH are collaborating on a study of whether extending the dose time would help prevent some of those rebounds. So one of the theories behind why people might be rebounding, if it is in fact related to Paxlovid, is that they're just not taking the drug for long enough. And so, you know, if it turns out that an 8-day course means that virtually nobody is rebounding, then that changes the calculus again. And that, you know, in this hypothetical future, then maybe prescribing Paxlovid becomes an easier decision for doctors and pharmacists to make. That's one possible future. Another possible future is nothing changes about the drug, doctors and patients continue having these conversations, and some doctors decide to do it, some doctors decide not to, depending on various risk factors, and it becomes a tool that is available to individuals, some of whom use it and some of whom don't. As far as broader implications, Paxlovid is something you give to people after they have already gotten COVID. And there's a whole world of things that we as a country, we as a global community could be doing to prevent that very first step, which is preventing people from getting COVID. So things like, you know, smarter approaches to masking, smarter and perhaps more enforced approaches to ventilation upgrades, testing requirements, improved access to testing, improved speed of testing, improved accuracy of testing. All these things could help, you know, stop chains of transmission and prevent people from even needing Paxlovid. And it would still be great to have it available if somebody did in fact get infected. But certainly it seems like it could do more good as part of a wider ecosystem of care.
Rachel Gutman-Way, thank you so much for your reporting and for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Lizzie.
Rachel Gutman-Way is a senior associate editor at The Atlantic. All right, that is it for the show today. What Next TBD is produced by Evan Campbell. Our show is edited by Tori Bosch. Joanne Levine is the executive producer for What Next. Alicia Montgomery is vice president of audio for Slate. TBD is part of the larger What Next family, and it's also part of Future Tense, a partnership of Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. We will be back next week with more episodes. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening.
We Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.